Mexico, now with Greater America. So it builds up. So over to you, Adam, and you can pull it.
Yeah. Just leave it on the.
This isn't the camera, I don't think.
No, no, we're not at the bounce.
No, that's okay. Just leave it.
We should be
out there. Well, thank you all for coming out to hear this talk. I see this red. Okay, I wanted to make sure before it lit up and then it stopped. So, so yes, this was, if you read the abstract or possibly even the article, this was all based on an article I wrote for a Significance magazine that was in 2016. In fact, I think every year they have a young statisticians writing contest. So back in early 2016, I wrote an article, sent it in, and was one of the three finalists. And then it turned out, after presenting this work a year ago, a little over a year ago, at the RSS conference in Manchester, that I got to take the first prize. They liked my article. So today I'll be going over this again, as I did before, but also since 2016, there's a lot of changes have happened in U.S. politics. So. Again, this is not just On the Frequency of America in America, my original title, but also now we have America is Apparently Greater these days, as is claimed in the rhetoric. The story begins sort of in early 2016 with data mining political speeches. So a lot of people, I think, ask this, again, I'll get to the main topic. But if you read the abstract, you know it's on tracking the usage of the word America by American politicians, specifically presidents. And people said, well, why in the world did you do that? It just seems a bit strange to even think that. So I thought I would tell a little tale, which is that sometime around there, I was, let's say, procrastinating on my PhD, and I thought maybe I would try writing a Huffman encoding algorithm, right. You know, because that's how I like to procrastinate. So if you're not familiar, this is a data compression technique. And a simple way to consider it is that an English letter character, we have 26 characters, which means with 5 binary bits, we have 32 possible combinations. So we could represent every character, let's say, with 5 binary bits, and a few combinations left over for spaces, punctuation marks, and the like. But this isn't really efficient, right? Because some characters are much more common than others. So the letter E is very frequent in standard English, whereas the letter Z is very infrequent. So the concept of this Huffman encoding in a high-level sense is just, well, we should probably try to use fewer bits to represent the very common letters and more bits to represent the uncommon letters. And it just makes sense from just an efficiency in coding. And there are ways to make this precise. Of course, a lot of this idea of information theory, entropy, and whatnot. But effectively, the first, in some sense, that's all I really care about, because this can be extended also to substrings. So it's not just characters, but if you're trying to compress a document, you might find words or phrases that are repeated over and over again. And then you can effectively run one of these compression algorithms to decide how many bits to use to represent that information. So the more frequent something is, the fewer bits we want to use to represent it, because we want this to be as efficient as possible. And this is part of what happens when you zip a file. There's more things going on, I believe, in the standard zip algorithm, but one of the things it does is it builds one of these Huffman trees that it uses to encode. Again, I was procrastinating and thought, well, I'm going to try and write my own version of this algorithm just to kind of explore how it works. And the first thing I needed to do was to in some sense build this algorithm, I needed to first write a program that would count substrings. Basically, given a certain length of a string in a text file, it would go through and say how many times did that occur to the very frequent ones, the ones that we want to represent with fewer bits. So I did this on this collection of political speeches, specifically the State of the Union addresses by American presidents. And for the first 190 years, yes, 190 years of the data set, about 95% of the time, the most common 7-letter string was of space the space. So that's really not that interesting. It kind of makes sense, though. It's common. It can show up in many different areas. So at first, that's not that exciting. But if we look at the next 36 years, the most recent, the most common 7-letter substring is America. And that, I thought, was quite fascinating and sort of required a little bit of follow-up research just to see what's actually going on here. So then my quest in some sense was try to model the usage of the word America throughout I believe in total 227 years worth of speeches in total. So the first thing is...
Interesting that they have almost identical percentages.
It is actually, yeah, that they were, I think in, there were some other ones in there, like people, space, for example, became a seven character string that was common at some point, but I sort of just broke it up there because America started showing up, I think, in the 70s more frequently, but then after about 1980, I think that was, if I'm remembering correctly, that would have been around the time of Reagan showed up, and then suddenly it was America up until present day, it seemed almost ubiquitous. So it was, it was an interesting pattern, and I thought as a statistician, you know, we like interesting patterns and trying to understand them in the data. I guess it's not surprising to say that American presidents like to talk about America. So even from the beginning, we have people like James Madison talking about how the American people will face this it with undaunted spirit, being the fact that at that point in time, the British were back and we were fighting again, in this case during the War of 1812. And then a little bit later, you have James K. Polk, who is responsible for basically taking the entire southwest of the country away from Mexico and bringing it into the United States. And he talks about the American principle of self-government. Here he talks about in the past saying it was able to defeat sort of the British and the French interference, and then goes on to talk about how we'll also defeat the Mexicans, and that's exactly what happened in history.
This is a quick point.
Yes.
The adjective American is deemed to contain an instance of America.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I'll get to this when I get to the actual data, when I talk about it more precisely, but as I was looking specifically for substrings, that means the usage of America also includes American, Americans, and other, I believe that's all of them, except I believe there was an Americanization that shows up somewhere in there as well. So, but as long as that string, that seven characters shows up, it gets counted in my data, in my accounts. But yes, so this was 19th century, but even in the 20th century, we still have more references to America in the rhetoric. That's why I love political rhetoric. It's just fascinating to read some of these documents and speeches that have been from the past, with Roosevelt and his New Deal talking about it coming from the American people, or with Eisenhower now with the new enemy of the day, the communists, talking about how American freedom is threatened. But still, they're always invoking the word America, American, in these speeches. So what I thought was, this happened again back in early 2016, before the election of our 45th president. And my thought was, what are the odds, right, that the 45th president says the word America? Now, this is not precise at all. This is a very strange question to ask, but I thought, let's try to be a little bit more precise. And let's ask instead, what are the odds that a uniformly randomly selected word from the 2017 State of the Union address is America? And that's something that we can actually quantify mathematically. If I were to sort of draw a word at random, what is the probability that I get the word America, or American, or Americans, or et cetera? So that was my goal, was to model, to basically answer this question. And I was looking at the State of the Union address, which is this speech that happened early in the year, every year. But it wasn't always that way. It's basically, it was written into the beginning, the very fabric of the Constitution from day one, that the president shall from time to time give Congress information on the State of the Union. It wasn't really made precise as to how frequently or in what form that should be. But these days, it's very common for sometime in January or February for an incoming president to basically give such an address to Congress. So there's a joint session of Congress. So a brief history. It began with Washington way back in 1790, at the very beginning, again, of the country. But then after Washington and Adams, the first two presidents, it changed to being written reports. So it was no longer a speech. It was a written report by the president that was delivered by a, I guess, a page or an assistant to Congress, because I guess Jefferson was still, you know, one of these political philosophers of the early country and thinking to himself that, oh, a president addressing the Congress seems too much, too regal, and we're trying to be different than that, right? We don't want this to be a king speaking from the throne. So his feelings were we should have a written report and sent off. So even though the manner of delivery changed, the political rhetoric was still there. And granted, some of them in the 19th century became quite verbose because, again, they were just writing this, so they could sort of go on and on about sort of the strange sort of details of the day. But this continued all the way through the 19th century until Woodrow Wilson, in 1913, who sort of broke the trend and addressed Congress directly in a speech. And then after that, it was a little bit back and forth. Some presidents were giving speeches, some would go back to doing written documents. But then technology also comes into play, right? Because now we're in the 20th century, and we have Calvin Coolidge in 23, who does the first radio broadcast. So now his voice is going out across the country. After World War II, we have Truman with the first TV broadcast.
Was it also delivered to Congress in a chamber?
It was, yes. Yeah, I believe, I'm not sure about the radio broadcast. I believe by the time the TV broadcast happened with Truman, it was certainly in the chamber. With Calvin Coolidge, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that, again, it was a little bit ambiguous. There wasn't, again, it's not set in stone how it should be delivered, so in some cases it was a speech given, other times it was a written document, but, and then ultimately, by the time the 60s came along, right, these TV broadcasts before were daytime television, so they were on TV, but people didn't have, VCRs, let alone DVRs, and YouTube and whatnot, so they weren't able to necessarily watch it. But then, again, come the 60s with President Johnson, suddenly now you have evening broadcasts, so everybody can, who's home from work can go sit and listen to the president speak. And I think this really affects the rhetoric in some sense, because now you're talking not just to the Congress, but you're talking to everyone can listen. Going all the way up to the most recent, I guess, adaption of technology, which was President Bush, the second Bush, in 2002, doing a webcast online. So now, not only is it network television, but it's around the world. You can tune in and watch live streaming the president speaking to the country, to the people, and to the world in some sense. So the corpus of data is quite fascinating, I think. So we have, again, 227 years of speeches, now 228 with the recent with the addition of Trump here, but 42 of the 44 presidents delivered one. Two of them were sadly never actually made it a whole year and weren't able to deliver a speech. But besides that, so we have 42 of the 44. The total size of the corpus is over 1.75 million words. And of that, a little bit more than half come in the form of written reports. They can be a bit more verbose than the speeches, which, of course, are a bit more streamlined. And again, reiterating what I had from the first slide, the idea that early on, you don't see this, the usage of America, if you just do a raw count of what's the most common substring, but then suddenly it pops up with a very high frequency, almost completely, in the last 36 years.
Just as a matter of interest, did you also note what proportion was America before?
I'm not sure what so I have the proportions in the analysis that I'm about to do.
I'm wondering how close behind was America until it took.
It's true. I didn't actually compare the proportions to the other proportions of other substrings, like let's say the maximum, the most common versus America. I didn't see how that changed, but that is an interesting point because eventually, yeah, it'll take over. I will say this set of this corpus of documents, as well as many others, are available online at this American Presidency Project, which is run by two professors out of I think UC Santa Barbara, if I remember correctly. Yeah, UCSB down there. So it's an excellent data set if you enjoy text mining and other things of that nature. Because I'm sure you can even do more sophisticated things than what I do with a lot of these techniques that exist today for mining documents and whatnot, things like latent directional allocation and all these bag of words models. But the tool I'm using is significantly more, let's say, rudimentary. It's a classic. It's the logistic regression. So to make sure we're all on the same page, right, I want to model the frequency of this, of the usage of the word America. And what I'm going to try to do is a logistic regression to model that. Now, in the simplest case, right, the way this would start off, we have some linear model, but our response, instead of being real valued and, let's say, having a normal distribution, as we might do in, you know, vanilla ordinary least squares, we now have y having a Bernoulli distribution, so it's going to be a plus or a minus 1. And as this doesn't follow the usual regression assumptions, what we'll often do is transform it with the so-called logistic function here. So what we ultimately do is we're modeling the expected value of y given an input in x, our regressor or predictor x. And we have our logistic response function here, which we can then rearrange. And then what we're really modeling is we're trying to predict the log of the odds ratio, which is this guy here on the left side, in terms of our predictors. So this is the standard setup. But in some sense, I don't have just zeros or ones. I have a frequency. So what I have is I really have a binomial random variable, given that I have n, the number of words that I'm in the entire document. I'm looking at what's the probability of one of those being America. So what I'm really interested in here is understanding what pi is, that is the frequency of America. And what I do is I use this logistic regression, again, with the idea of having a binomial model here, to try to predict the log odds ratio, and then transform that back into frequencies of yi divided by n. So that's exactly what I did for the sake of the article. For the talk today, though, I want to talk about one other alternative that I didn't include in the article because I found it was harder to interpret, and part of the point of the article was to tell a statistical story in an interesting way, and I found that this other way was a bit more complex, but for the sake of the talk today, I thought it would be fun to include it, which is to consider the Poisson regression, because instead of looking at a frequency, right, in the logistic case, I'm trying to model the frequency. In the Poisson case, I'm trying to model the raw counts, the number, the actual number of Americas that occur in the document or the speech. And that's exactly what the Poisson regression is going to do. It's going to give me a non-negative integer out with the usual Poisson density there. And then what I'm modeling here is the log of the expected count in terms of my regressors or my predictors. So in this case, it also becomes a little bit more complicated because I use, and I'll show you later, that I use not just the sort of the year or the precedence number as a predictor, but I also have to then include the word count as a predictor as well for this model. But I think it's interesting how you can, in some sense, consider it in two ways, one as raw counts or one as frequencies. So those are the ways I want to model this data. So then I say, well, what exactly are the odds? So whenever I think of odds, I always think of it in the case of betting or gambling, right? In some sense, it's not the frequency, it's the probability of winning. So again, sort of the frequency divided by 1 minus that frequency, the probability of losing. So again, if I have something like 10 to 1 odds, then a fair bet of £1 should return £10 if I win the bet, giving that it should have, let's say, a fair outcome. And that's exactly, so what I'm really modeling here is the number of Americas divided by the number of other words in the document is really what the odds here are. And we can compute this, right, for the historical data, all the way going back to some of the earlier presidents who are coming in closer to 500 to 1,000 to 1 when it comes to the odds of this this so-called bet of what's the probability that my random word that I pick is going to be America. But then, by the time we get to the 20th century and moving into the 21st century, we're up to about 100, a little bit over 100 to 1 odds with Reagan, and then under that at 93 to 1 odds with President Obama. So again, this is what I'm trying to model with the logistic regression. So again, what we're doing here is I'm looking at the log of the expected odds And I'm trying to predict that with the president's number. So the number just being the number in the sequence, one being Washington, two Adams, up to 44 being Obama. So I can do that. I can plug my data set into R, and I can solve for A and B, my parameters here for the model. And I get a B, sort of my estimator here, B hat, comes in at basically 0.081. And that's in some sense the rate. I can also construct a confidence interval, so that's coming in somewhere between a little bit below 0.7 and a little bit above 0.07, and a little bit between that and about 0.1, in some sense 0.096. But then this is for the log of the expected odds, if I sort of rework this by exponentiating both sides, it means that the odds are going to increase somewhere around 7 to 10% with each additional precedent. So if you think of this in some sense as an investment, right? I'm modeling this in some cases as some sort of an exponential growth. It's kind of like a compound interest. If I put, how much am I going to make over the years? And a question that economists often ask is, well, how long will it take my investment to double? So in this case, in some sense, the odds at this 7 to 10% increase, the odds should cut in half every 8 to 10 precedents, which is quite a sort of an amusing growth there of the usage of this rhetoric in the speeches. And I can also do prediction, right? Because this is that's ultimately what I wanted to do back in 2016 was say, well, we don't know who the 45th president of the United States is going to be, but I can try to predict what this odds is for the speech, or the ratio, or the frequency of America in the speech. So using this model, the predicted odds comes in somewhere between 102 to 67 to 1, whereas that corresponds to a frequency of about 1 to 1.5% of all words in the speech being the word America, or Americans, etc., which I find a bit amusing, a little bit hilarious in the sense that it just keeps growing like that.
To what extent is the linear assumption possible? To what extent is the linear relationship possible between the
Oh, and as well, so ultimately, yeah, that comes to the fit, which is the fit of it is actually quite surprisingly good. So it's true. It's like, does this actually model the data? But here's this might actually help answer is the plot. So this is the actual data where I have the I transformed it back into the frequency domain from the odds. So on the vertical axis here, we have the frequency, or in this case, the percentage of Americas in the speech, with the president's number as the predictor here, and it's actually kind of striking the way it just increases at this sort of exponential growth here. So I have the best my logistic regression curve here in blue, and then computed this 95% confidence band via bootstrap resampling of the data to.
There's a suggestion there that one should perhaps be using a nonlinear fit because the middle range of precedents are almost entirely beneath the fit, whereas at the top end,
we have this group in here that all falls below the line versus, fair enough, yes.
So it's, they should be pulling that blue line down a bit over that range, which suggests a nonlinear model.
No, certainly. I think you could certainly try some more sophisticated techniques here. Again, I think in my case, I tried the two that were the simplest, the logistic and the Poisson. The logistic gave me enough of a nice fit that I decided to just stick with that for the sake of the article. But it is true. There's plenty more that could be considered with this this data set. Actually, that would be actually quite interesting to run such a thing and see exactly how it fits.
And you've got the occasional weirdo president. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a couple of these as outliers just to kind of show exactly like which of these points that seem to be away from the curve. But then the other thing is that in the course, as you know, and some of you will know that in the logistic regression, unlike classic least squares regression, is that the variance is no longer constant as we move. So the points that might look like outliers might not necessarily be outliers because the variance as we move towards the right half of the curve is much higher than it is on the left side. And that's, I believe, exactly what we get here, is I can also look at the standardized residuals here for this logistic regression. And here, suddenly, all of those precedents that I had labeled before don't look as exciting. I have the 95% sort of unadjusted interval, and then when we apply a Bonferroni correction, we sort of move that interval up, and there's really only one precedent who stands above the rest as being sort of atypical with respect to this model, and that becomes James Madison. Interestingly enough, being the, well, historians might argue, because I don't think I'm not a historian, but arguably he's the first wartime president. I mean, there was a lot of skirmishes, of course, that were happening during that early days, but that was the first time when suddenly it wasn't just a skirmish with some local group. It was the United Kingdom that was back, right, during the War of 1812, and it was probably much more of an existential crisis than some of the other issues that previous presidents had to deal with. So perhaps that was why suddenly the rhetoric comes back quite strongly. And that's why I gave him, in my talk, the winner of the Most American President Award for such sort of beautiful lines as this, you know, with the skill and bravery, right, of these people here, and how the American flag had an auspicious triumph. His speech, which in some sense was actually a written document, is just full of this sort of beautiful rhetoric, talking about sort of the triumph of the flag and all of this. Again, they don't make speeches like that these days, you know. And even the more eloquent, say, people like President Obama, who has been said to have. The phrase is back in the, after reading so many of these documents, you just have to love some of the beauty of the early political rhetoric and the way they wrote and spoke. But that was in some sense the end of what I talked about in the article, right, in the case of the significant article which I submitted in May. So then came the summer of 2016 with the national conventions. And here we have Hillary Clinton talking at the Democratic National Convention all about America, talking about America's destiny and my fellow Americans, and America will be greater than ever, etc. And then at the Republican Convention we have Donald Trump with his interesting sort of repetitive rhetoric here about America will be strong again and proud again and safe again, and of course his slogan, it'll be, they're going to make America great again. So I thought it was it'd be interesting then to, again, at this point, we still didn't have sort of a new data point for the 2017 State of the Union, but I thought it'd be interesting to look at these speeches and see how they sized up. Well, this is the frequency chart, which gets back almost to the very beginning of the talk where I talked about character frequencies, right? So these are, here we have English language character frequencies, and what I put in here are the frequency of America for different presidents. So we have Madison, which was our most American president, but still early on, so it was only about 0.24%, where President Obama comes in here at 1%, over 1% of the speech being the word America. Here Clinton is referring to Hillary Clinton's DNC speech, and Trump referring to, of course, Trump's RNC speech. So Clinton being a little bit lower than Trump, who was a bit higher. And then I also included, just for fun, in the article and in this graph, Hughes, which is not a president, who's a poet, Langston Hughes. And I think this, I'm kind of hoping that this will catch on in frequency analysis, my so-called Langston Hughes constant of 2.355%, which is the frequency of America in the Langston Hughes poem, Let America Be America Again, which I think is just a good reference point, because if you're saying America that frequently, you've kind of gone beyond even political rhetoric to the sense of some poetic side.
And given that it is a poet, does the line "Let America be America" again get repeated?
It does.
Yes.
So yeah, this is a bit just sort of fun on my part, but it is true. I mean, you look at the poem, and the poem's actually, I forget the actual details, but it's a bit cynical as from his perspective of America. But yes, they repeat this line a lot in it. So you get a very high frequency of the word America in it. But with this, I thought, well, let's plot, let's say we don't know what the next president's going to, what they're going to say, he or she at this point. But what we can do is we can plot that. So this is the plot with respect to the logistic regression. So here we have the most recent presidents, and I had where Trump came in and where Clinton came in, and I made the joke, I thought it was a joke at the time, saying, oh, it looks like Clinton's not saying America frequently enough, she better start talking about America more if she wants to win the election. And that was October, so or September, and little did I know that 2 months later, she would lose the election. So while I don't claim at all that there's any predictive power in this, it still kind of bothered me because I'm like, I sort of intended this to be a joke because I think that most people did not actually expect Donald Trump to be the 45th president of the United States. But there he is, and actually speaking right on line with our prediction. So now, it's actually now 2017, we actually have some data points. So I mean, that was my, just for fun, I put in his convention speech because it was a big speech that he gave during the election. But now we actually have a State of the Union address, and I can plug that right in. And there he is, sort of on the upper end there of the confidence band, but still within, in some sense, the margin of error. And if you look at the residuals, he's not that far off because of the variance. And I'm not sure if you followed the news coverage, but it was quite funny in February after he gave this speech, and all the pundits were saying, Trump sounded very presidential during that speech, almost like it was a sort of a surprise or like a high bar to pass, right? They always joke, other presidents have to sort of really show off, like, hey, well, he's very presidential, and at least with respect to the frequency of America in his speech, he was kind of following with the pattern of past presidents.
Is the case of having become a president that you might want to be
possibly. I mean, I think that, I mean, oftentimes, so there's, it's actually an interesting question because ultimately, I mean, I'm not sure what it was like back 200 years ago, but these days, they're not really writing, the presidents are not writing their speeches, they have speech writers, they're, of course, they're probably editing them, but in some sense, their speech is written by someone else, and speech writers can come and go, so it would almost be, if there was data on it, it would be interesting to see, like, if speech writers change during a president's, let's say, 4 or 8 years, and how that changes the tone of the speech. But before this talk's over, I will talk a little bit about the inaugural addresses, and that's something, some different things happened during Trump's inaugural address. But before we get to that, I just wanted to look back at that Poisson regression, because for the sake of the article, again, I did logistic regression, but we can also use a Poisson regression here, where I have two predictors here, the president's number, but also now the word count, which again, I don't really know a priori, so as a predictor, it's not exactly the kind of thing that I can plug into my model. I would have to do some sort of a guess at that if I really wanted to, again, predict this. But what's interesting is that when you do this, you get out a rate constant, this B hat, that's extremely close to the other one. The other one, logistic regression, was 0.081, and now I have my 0.083 with a slightly tighter confidence band here for that estimate. But it's saying that, again, last time I had about a 7 to 10% increase in the odds. Now I'm getting about an 8 to 9 increase in the actual number of Americas in the talk. And I think the C, in some sense, the other parameter here for word count, has an interesting interpretation. It came in quite small, but still significant in the sense of the regression. And what it's kind of saying is that if I take the reciprocal of that, it's kind of dividing the word count by about 73,000. And if I'm a little bit above that, then I would expect maybe a slightly higher percentage frequency of a count of Americas versus if I'm lower than that. But in some sense, for trying to predict the word count, even given the actual, I should say, trying to predict the America count using this model, did not do very well because it was based on the word count being much higher because for every president I was modeling it with 4 to 8 years in general of speeches and writings versus Trump's one. So this was, in some sense, this is the raw counts data. So now forget about the frequency. divided by the total, and you can see what the raw American counts look like. And this is my Poisson regression curve fit to the data given the word count. So it's just an interesting way that you can model this in a slightly different.
Why do you have to introduce? Isn't it that some offset, which is just the denominator, which is just modeling the rate of word count of America?
No, it's true. I mean, it's true. You can think of them. I just think they're sort of two different things, but they both in some sense can be applied in the same setting. But I agree. In some cases, it's in some sense, it's just dividing by the word count or not. And you're right. I could consider it as some sort of rate of America instead of a frequency of America. So that's true. So then this actually, so in between the State of the Union, the election and the State of the Union, came President Trump's inaugural address, and then I was contacted again by the editor of Significance, and he said, well, can you run this analysis, but run it on the inaugural addresses, which is a much smaller data set, because only 40 of the 45 presidents gave an inaugural address. The total word count is now only about 135,000. So what I thought was, well, this will be interesting to try this, because this was before the State of the Union in February. This was in January. Let's try to see if we can, what we can do here. So again, fitting this logistic regression to the first 44 presidents, I get a rate parameter that they have, which is actually quite similar to the State of the Union, a slightly smaller, but it's still ballpark, a similar rate of increase that we're observing in the frequency of America. And what I got was a prediction for Trump that about 1.11% of his speech should be the word America based on the historic data. Also doing the Poisson regression again, we get a very similar result, which is that we get a rate of about 0.09. And again, in that case, I think the frequency they predicted was a little bit higher, somewhere around 1.42% given his word count for the speech. So what actually happened was he came in around 2.37%. So it was significantly higher, and the fact that almost, more than one out of like every 50 words or one out of 40 words almost was, the word America, the count coming in at 34. And the best line could be summed up by former President George W. Bush, where he allegedly said, though he hasn't confirmed it, that this was some weird stuff going on here. And yes, anyone who I think witnessed that speech said this is quite atypical for an inaugural address, and sort of painting a very stark and vision of the country, say. And yes, looking at the data, so fitting the logistic regression to the inaugural addresses, this is what we have here, where we have this, again, this nice increase here in the data, and then Trump is just way above the rest here, like much higher. In fact, he even did break that so-called Langston Hughes constant that I had at 2.355%. He came in at 2.37, so again, he has reached the realm of the poets, and has gone beyond politicians with his words here. And then again, just to follow up with the similar analysis as we did for the logistic regression, I can also look at the residuals and then the adjusted confidence interval, and Trump is really right on the threshold there. In this case, Adams, the second president, happened to have a much higher amount of Americas in his speech, again, because when you're on this far left side of the logistic regression, the variance is so low that we don't expect to see very high counts at all. Yes, and more or less, here's just the other, the Poisson approach. So again, we can also take this Poisson case, which again has very similar results. It's just a little bit harder, I think, again, to interpret, because you have to including the word count there. But either way, they both sort of missed the subtle brilliance, say, of Trump's speech, and the way that his inaugural address was far beyond, and beyond the others. And I think that's exactly why the pundits were so impressed with his State of the Union address sounding so presidential, because everyone came away from the inauguration thinking, what are we getting ourselves into with this? So I will end with the question of, what do we think about the usage of America? Powerful rhetoric or some silly cliche? Like I said in the article, I don't expect this trend to necessarily continue, because if it does, we're going to have a president spending a good hour talking to Congress and just shouting America at them, which, who knows, we'll see in another 50 years or so what's happening during this address. When will it, eventually, I imagine it should level out, but so far it hasn't been, it keeps increasing. So again, but I guess at the beginning though, you have to think that there is some powerful rhetoric in this. When you look at the history of speeches, it's quite fascinating, and the ability to move sort of people and try to bring them together under this banner. So I guess only time will tell what history will give to us. So with that, we have two examples here. We have our State of the Union address, and then we have one of the more brilliant things I've ever seen, which was in 2016, Budweiser's America the Beer. We'll see what the future holds for the country and for the rest of us, but thank you for your time.
I'm very sorry to have missed the last few moments of that.
Sorry.
But what I did see was fascinating, interesting, and beautifully presented. And as traditional with this group, you've had quite a few questions during the talk. But are there any residual questions?
When you're showing your residuals and your 95%, what do you adjust for? Like if you have the 95%,
so that was doing the simplest multiple testing correction, which would be the Bonferroni correction. The idea that if I have something that I believe has a normal distribution, then I imagine that 95% of the time it should be within, I guess, 1.96 standard deviations of the mean. But the idea is that I was doing that for 44 and then 45 presidents. So the probability of this occurring, right, if I want the probability to be 95% for one test, then I basically divide that 0.05 rate, I guess a false positive rate, by the total number of tests to get whatever that would be, and then compute a new bound, which would be much higher. So that way, when I run the test in some sense for each president, so I'm running the same test 44 or 45 times, I want the overall probability of a false positive to be 95%. So it's just adjusting the false positive rate of my test. Right, it's kind of like if the probability of rolling a 6 on a die is like 1 in 6, but if I roll 6 dice, then suddenly the probability of getting at least 1-6 is much higher than 1 in 6.
I'm familiar with adjusting for so what are the reasons? Could you go back to...
Oh, yes. Yeah, we can go back to, I guess, this is, for example...
Standardized residuals?
Yes.
So
that's the difference, right, between the point and the regression line, standardized based on the variance and everything, which is precisely why the left-hand side, for example, you have these very tiny deviations, absolutely, if I just look at the difference from the point to the line. But once I actually account for the variance, then these points are much higher away from the blue line than most of the rest. Because right, if we did this with the ordinary least squares regression type setting, we assume constant variance throughout our model, and we're just looking at the diff. Well, I guess you would standardize it anyway to the estimation of the variance, but you'd standardize it similarly across the whole thing.
Have you considered taking into account as a factor whereabouts on the political spectrum a particular president is?
So that's a very interesting question, and I thought briefly about that. Specifically, with the more recent presidents. And I didn't see any. I tried doing that with some of, like, let's say the last, the post World War II presidents. Because the problem is that political parties have changed so much that it's hard to define what exactly would be a Republican back in the 19th century. Who would, you know, there are other parties that no longer exist, like the Whigs and. So you could maybe a historian would have some index of, say, conservative liberal ideology that you might be able to apply here. But what I did try actually to do that a bit with, again, the most recent presidents, but I didn't find any noticeable pattern there looking at, just because since World War II and maybe slightly before, the Republicans and the Democrats have solidified a bit. But even so, the parties are still changing, right? So they have their core beliefs, but of course they're always shifting a bit with the feelings of the people and everything. So I think it is a very interesting question, though. But at least from my quick analysis, I did not find anything like that.
I'm not quite sure if I'm phrasing this question correctly, but did you get a feel for the vocabulary of the different presidents, in the sense that if you take a very educated man like Obama, he would have a wide portfolio of words that he could use. And someone like Trump, with perhaps less formal education, he has fewer words to use. Okay. And so America is going to occur more if it's one of his words.
One of the words he knows.
That's right. It is true.
The early presidents, I don't know whether they had a wide vocabulary or not.
Yeah, I mean, so I haven't actually done any sort of a word... Yeah, sort of a vocabulary test. I mean, just early on, you see much. I think, in some sense, that was something that I was originally interested in, was because I find that, again, maybe it's just looking back with some sort of a nostalgia that, like, you have these really eloquent speeches using sort of grandiose vocabulary that we wouldn't see these days, because, in some sense, back then, right, the people they were talking to their peers in Congress, and they were trying to speak very eloquently, whereas. Now the presidents are speaking, in some sense, to the people. They're trying to talk. I hate to say dumb it down, but they're trying to talk to a mass audience, right? And I think that, again, I'm not sure what the feelings are maybe on this side of the Atlantic, but I guess that there's almost a. I was talking with some of my PhD colleagues about this, and we were joking. There's almost like an anti-intellectual side to America in general. This kind of like. Every man kind of person, like plain talking, plain speaking American president, right?
To a less educated audience.
Yeah, so almost like just like a man of the people, right? You know, not like some academic who's going to be speaking with these long, grandiose sentences and words. But it is true. And the other thing, though, I think that's interesting is that recently, right, it's all speechwriters now, too. So it's not so much even if, you know, you might claim that, I mean, people will claim that, you know, President Obama was smarter than Bush, like the previous one, but a lot of times their speeches are coming directly from writers as well, so it's maybe not as tailored. I mean, of course, they're going to have some input into it, but it might not be, it's not 100% their own writing, which will certainly affect things. But yeah, it is interesting, and I think even looking at Obama's speeches, and, you know, he's known to be very intelligent and very eloquent. You can see that his speech is very different, though, from those early speeches of the country. I mean, the words are still much plainer, in some sense, than early on. But it would be interesting to compare, say, his speeches, some of the more recent speeches that are at least on the same playing level compared to the early ones for vocabulary usage. I would almost bet that it would be not as different as you'd expect because, again, the speech writers were all kind of trained to try to talk to the broad audience of the people and not, but look at the data, perhaps.
Just on, when did speech writers come in, going across the presidential numbers?
So, I don't know. Honestly, I'm not even sure. Yeah. You could claim, I mean, who knows, maybe it actually does go back to the beginning. I honestly don't know much about the history of that at all. I know these days it's certainly, they have speech writers for everything, but again.
We do get new words coined, don't you? I mean, this place, fake news.
Yes.
It's been on the doors here. And there must be more words around now than the were years ago. I mean, I possibly lose words as well, but there's always a changing, isn't there, sort of the guard in what words are available.
No, it is true, it is true. And I mean, yeah, politicians have been known to make up their own words as well. So, President Bush being a good example of that, I think. Though I don't think any of his have caught on as much. But.
Well, when you, I saw Clinton, I kept thinking Hillary Clinton, because it's a husband. You sort of forget she had a husband, don't you?
No, it's true, true. No, that was Bill there. So no, I did not. I was just, this was more or less everything I did in the analysis. But yes, I mean, I think that the corpus of documents is very rich and interesting and readily available, so I'm sure there's a lot of interesting analysis that people could do. Again, using more sophisticated techniques from just, say, nonlinear regression to let alone to, you know, all these text-based analyses that people love to do these days. No, it's true. I mean, you could have some things like that put in there as well. And no, I didn't follow up with, you know, one of these things where I put in like lots of regressors to see what came out. My original thing was just looking, well, trying to model frequencies, so let's try the logistic regression and see what happens. And again, with the premise of the writing competition was tell a sort of statistical story in an interesting way, so try to explain a concept in statistics like here, logistic regression, using some interesting data set.
And you wonder what would happen if you did have another country like Britain. But I mean, you see, there's Britain and United Kingdom, England, Wales, Scotland, and I was thinking, you know, you've got America, but you could also just say United States, wouldn't you?
No, it's true.
I'm particular, you have a big problem, because when you talk about Great Britain, great is a geographical term. It's not, it doesn't mean great as in fantastic. It just means the island of Britain and the big islands. That's Great Britain.
Yes.
Britain is just the one island, and so the word great would have to be separated out.
Yes. I mean, you've also got the British Isles as well. I mean, there's so many sort of little bits and bobs in Britain.
There's Britain, Great Britain, the British Isles, the United Kingdom. They're all very different.
In this case, I didn't actually rerun it with looking for United States as a word. It might be interesting to see how, if that trends with it as well. But I find with the rhetoric, it's always sort of America, American is the way, like the American people, the American freedom, America this, America that.
Because the size of America's changed, didn't you? So many states.
No.
Still America, I suppose, but I mean the French were there, weren't they?
They were all in the plains area, like Louisiana and whatnot, and heading up into the middle of the country.
So America, as we know it today, it wasn't the America years ago.
No, it has changed a lot.
I find it amazing, the French were actually there, and I think they had to pay them an astronomical sum to take him back off the French.
Yeah, that was the famous Louisiana Purchase, I believe. If I recall correctly, that was, again, this is my, I'm not a historian, but if I recall correctly, that was Jefferson and I believe Napoleon actually selling it, I think. I might be wrong, but I think they in some sense sold the land, I guess I believe in some sense to finance his own war campaign and things like that, but I should double check that, but I believe trying to go back to like grade school history now.
And of course, Russia owned Alaska.
Yes. That was, I want to say, in like the 1850s or something. That was purchased, and it wasn't a state for a while. It was just a territory. But I think they really hated it back when it happened. It was like sort of like a folly. Like, what? Why did you purchase that big frozen chunk of land? You know. During the Cold War, I'm sure they were happy about it. They thought, oh, this is great.
You don't buy countries now, do you? I mean, it just seems up to, you know, putting Britain up for sale. And
yeah, selling off part of, you know.
You just can't imagine it.
East Anglia. How much do you want for it?
You get gazumped by Bosnia or something.
Yes.
Anyway, yeah.
No, it's true. A different time.
They did that to Hong Kong.
Oh, Well, we have these little countries, and I mean, you know, Wales, I mean, Gibraltar, now you've got these things.
What are you going to do with it?
Of course, you've got the complication of dialects, haven't you, there? I mean, in America, I think it's English is fairly uniformly spoken, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But I know Spain, and I think Italy, you can have, villages can have their own language. So this would be more difficult. You might have a chap who speaks in dialect more. I don't know how the old word would have gone. There's some serious...
No, it's true, because the politician's trying to speak to the people in total, and it'd be interesting to see how that would work in other countries. I know that's what people ask me a lot about this, if you considered other countries, said no, but I said it would be certainly interesting to do if you can find a country with periodic speeches. The nice thing about the State of the Union and the inaugural addresses is that they happen with some regularity, so it's a nice periodic data set. I think in some of the, yeah, this one I have is when you condense it to president number, not every, it's not done uniformly by years, but like we have many more presidents in the latter half of the 19th century than in the first half of the 20th century, but it still has some regularity to it.
And a lot of these were actually written.
Yes.
I mean, I know the State of the Union, so that's an interest. I don't know, you know, written's different to when you speak, you know.
That's true. They were still presented. I think they were read, and it wasn't spoken, it wasn't a speech, but they were read to Congress. But it is true that some of the ones in the middle of the 19th century became quite long and dry, where they would talk about, oh, and the American farm production this year, et cetera, et cetera, and, you know, just a lot of extra details that you wouldn't get today in a speech, because people would just turn the channel.
Yeah, because well, yeah, we have short attention span, don't we, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not easy to think of examples outside of the subject area of politics. I mean, say in the UK, when in economics you can think of, well, you've got a consistent time series with the same brief given.
No, I think it's an excellent data set to analyze.
Yeah. I mean, the Mansion House speech for economics, the Chancellor of Exchequer in this country doesn't have anything Mansion House. Oh. That might be something, you know, mm-hmm. It's a certain length, and you could search for, I don't know, you could be fiscal, you know,
oh, yeah.
About what. But there must be lots of these different examples where, you know, your tools would be fantastic for teasing out, you know, complicated patterns over time.
No, exactly. I mean, I think there's so much more data in that data set yet to be looked at, but this is just one interesting feature that I noticed again one day in the data and thought, well, this would be kind of fun to try modeling, and I guess the folks at the RSS also thought it was interesting, so... I should count the frequency of it in my own talk with this.
In that case, then, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's off now.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. I think we've got a good one there. So let me just sit now. It's going to be...